Welcome to the Minimum Viable Podcast, a project of the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum. Our mission is to inspire, connect, and empower people in order to promote a culture of innovation in the U.S. national security community. You can learn more about DEF and get involved at DEF.org. That's DEF.org. We look forward to your ideas and are excited to connect you with other doers working on hard problems.
All right. So again, my name is Adam Furtado. I work at Kessel Run. I'm currently the chief of platform. And I've been here since its inception. I'm going to walk through a lot of that. A lot of the things I just heard from folks were around learning all the things that you guys can do to improve in whatever projects you're working on. We're going to go a different direction. I'm going to tell you all the things that I screwed up so you can avoid those in whatever project you're in. And hopefully that will be helpful. But I'm happy that I got reached out to by Aaron and Jay and Mikey and Caleb and company. It's really great to chat with a group of peers. I know a lot of you, right? And people I certainly highly respect. It's been a pleasure working with the past few years. So this is pretty exciting. I'm going to talk a bit about scaling Kessel Run, the challenges we've encountered, how we've tackled some of them, how we continue to fail at others, and some ways that I've built some perspectives and empathy and put some tools in my leadership toolbox that might be able to help you in your neck of the woods. But first, a little about me. So I joined the Air Force a month out of high school. In high school, my class rank was 187, and we graduated like 180. So there were 7 people who dropped out who had better grades than I did in high school. Not a high performer, but I joined the Air Force about a month out of high school and changed my life in a whole bunch of ways. And the first job I had was doing this. So I was in the Air Force Honor Guard. I'm the guy in the foreground right there. My entire first job in the Air Force was doing funerals at Arlington National Cemetery of folks who were, you know, veterans who had passed away or active duty folks who were killed in action. It's a very sobering way to start a career as an 18-year-old idiot, for the most part, to really learn about why we all do what we do, right? All of us are here for the right reason. This is a mission-focused group, you can tell. And I learned really quickly the value of what we do and why it's important. So from there, my second assignment was as a targeteer. I retrained to more on the operator side. So my job was to go out and determine which effects to put on which targets. This is me deployed. I'm just kidding. That's not me. But I didn't have a cool deployment picture. It really bummed me out while I was making this. So I only found this blurry one of me packing up and getting ready to go. So I'll have to deal with that. But it's one of my bigger regrets of my active duty life of not having a cool picture with guns and stuff. But that's what I got. So did that for about 4 or 5 years. And this is where I actually used a lot of the software that I'm now trying to rebuild and make better, right? So I have a perspective coming first from understanding what happens when you have really shitty IT, and then what happens when you actually use it. And then as you keep going, I got out of the military and got into kind of government user experience and government acquisition. Then I understood why it was so hard to provide good IT, right? So I had the entire gambit of how hard this was to do. That picture right there is where the Agile Jesus picture, as you can see. This is where I kind of got into Kessel Run and starting from a traditional program office and acquisition and just getting really tired of the slowness and how hard it was to move and being surrounded by some really great people. I've had some really good ideas that I certainly deserve most of the credit there. So in most of my presentations the past few years, I'd probably start out with a slide like this. And I talk about how we have to make technological advancements and it's a strategic imperative as defined in our national defense strategy. I'd probably talk about how we need to combat the growths of China and Russia and how it's a strategic imperative to make sure that we stay ahead. I would have probably included a quote from Secretary Mattis, but I don't think I have to tell this group about the imperative here, right? We are all here because we already know what is important and what we need to do. So I'm going to skip this part, and I'm just going to assume we're starting from the same baseline of understanding that us as a government understanding technology in a better way is a strategic imperative that is going to lead, hopefully, to our survival. And then I think it is that important for us. So getting back to Kessel Run, we're an Air Force software organization. We build, deploy, operate cloud-native software to enable warfighters to do their jobs. Internally, we have 3 core product lines within the organization. Two of them are application development product lines. One of them is focused on operational command and control. Think air operations and planning and strategy of how we actually fight, plan, execute a war from an air perspective. The second product line is wing command and control. Think all the things you have to do to make the aircraft ready to go fight that war. Maintenance, making sure that the readiness is available from our fighter aircraft. The third product line underlies all that. We call it our all-domain common platform. This is where the DevOps comes in, the software factory terminologies come in. Underlying platform of products and services and support that support those two product lines, as well as a couple dozen other products that are built externally to Kessel Run throughout the Air Force and the government. We're a government-led and operated organization, and we've built this organization very intentionally with a focus on our culture and our people. Our initial undertaking here has been a bit of a shift in the way that we think about it. We always said when we first started off, we are here to turn the Air Force into a software company that can win wars. And we felt fundamentally, and we still feel, you can't outsource your way to the type of change we need. We can't do it alone either. We need a vibrant commercial sector and a real strong partnership between government and the commercial space. But building the government's competence in software is a strategic imperative. Even if we're going to use commercial solutions and commercial support, we have to understand what we're buying. And up until this point, we don't even understand that. So building the competency is super important. But all that's based around some cultural things that we hold dear internal Kessel Run that I think made us unique internally. We're starting to see some of this permeate. It's never been just about technology. It's about building an organization in the right way, showing the DoD that you can take these patterns that have made other companies and organizations successful and bring them into your organization to turn it into a really successful software organization. And our core values exemplify that, I think. The first, ideas over rank. This is a tool we use to enable psychological safety throughout our organization. If you come into our office when we were in the office, you would not see uniforms on our active duty folks. It's an opportunity for us to say that, no, your rank doesn't matter here on the ops floor. Similar to being in an air crew or a special forces unit, the best idea needs to win in order to be successful. So we have PMs here that are E5s or E9s and O4s, and they may lead people on their team, engineers who are of lower ranks. And that's totally okay. And the interesting thing here, though, is that the idea of psychological safety is almost diametrically opposed to what we've all grown up with within the military, right? The idea that you need a hierarchical command and control kind of structure for communication, which is imperative to success on the battlefield. You don't want to be in a trench, you know, getting everybody's opinion and democratically coming up with a good solution. But for building software and trying to figure out complex scenarios and problems, you need a way to get all of the ideas onto the table to be able to navigate those. And psychological safety allows us that opportunity. The second here, intense customer focus. This is basically focusing everything we do with customer centricity around our users and what actually needs to be done from an outcome perspective versus like an old requirements process. Jeff Patton has one of my favorite quotes of all time. He said, your job as a PM isn't to get the requirements right, it's to change the world. And that's the way that we kind of tackle the problems from a Kessel Run perspective as best we can. Bias for action means that we want to empower decisions to be made at the lowest level possible. We want decisions to be made where the context and the information lies and avoid kind of decision paralysis. We think about business decisions in the same way. We think about software, right? Let's put the thing in production. Let's measure if it works. Let's learn if we nailed it. If we didn't, let's adjust. Now we have more data. I think we try to use that wherever we can throughout the business of our organization. Then continuous evolution. We want to continue to have that growth mindset. We want to grow in everywhere we can, evolve from an organizational perspective, a software perspective, a people perspective. And we see that kind of everywhere we go. Our mission is to continuously deliver war-winning software our airmen love. This is a very purposeful mission statement. It includes three core concepts. So most of our teams work in a balanced team model. We worked with Pivotal early on and still do, and kind of took a lot of our core practices from what they've taught us. And part of that balanced team model is bringing three different equities to all work together to represent their kind of piece of the pie, if you will. So as an example, your product manager on a balanced team would be focused on business value. What do we need to get from a whole perspective or an outcome perspective? How do we make sure that we're tackling towards that? On the engineering side, we bring in a feasibility assessment. Is the thing that we're building the most simple thing we can do? Is it feasible for us to actually build? And then from a design perspective, is this what the user needs? Is it going to deliver user outcomes that we need? So if you look through our mission statement, we're continuously delivering on the engineering side. It's war winning, so we know it meets the optimization of the whole perspective, PM, and then make sure our airmen actually love it. And that's a weird thing to see in DoD software, right? Usually it's like, listen, dude, you're going to use what I tell you to use. I don't care that your UI looks like it's from 1976. You're just going to use it and you don't have an opinion. I want our people to actually like using our software. I want to be a platform of choice. I want our people to seek out our products and actually want to use them regardless of whether or not they're forced to. I don't want to live in that world. So in order to get there, it's kind of a long and winding story, but we named Kessel Run after Han Solo's smuggling route in Star Wars. And the idea here is that we felt we needed to smuggle this way of working and thinking into the world's largest bureaucracy, the Department of Defense. This actually picture here is of the dot vote we did in a pivotal office to actually determine the name. There's a bunch of options on there, and this one won out. And the thing that the Kessel Run story is interesting in that three different things came together at once, led by three different people. So all simultaneously, Colonel Enrique Odi was at DIUX at the time, trying to prove that commercial ways of working could work within the government. He partnered with the AOC at the 609th and started building a piece of software to prove that out from a prototype perspective. Simultaneously, on the other side of the country in Boston, Brian Kroger was at the TNG, or Targeting and GEOINT Program Office out at Hanscom Air Force Base. That's where I worked as well, and that's where I met Brian. And he had an entire goal of figuring out how to take all this legacy stuff and put it into the cloud. The unique thing about Brian is he also came from a user background. So him and I had a kinship there of like no longer wanting to have our users have the same experiences that we did in really important ways. And then while that was happening, the AOC program office, the Air Operations Center program office led by Jeremiah Sanders, was in the midst of a $500 million modernization effort. It wasn't going to be successful. We asked for about $250 million more and Congress had enough of it. At that point, you could count five different efforts trying to modernize the AOC worth over $1 billion all at the same time, simultaneously. That was not the way we wanted to do that, obviously. So from there, we set out, all these things kind of came together to prove that these modern processes, ways of working could change. And that's where Kessel Run was born. All these things come together fortuitously, but also strategically. And we had some big wins early. We piloted the first continuous ATO. We achieved continuous delivery to CIPRNet. We got adoption on multiple products, some in a matter of weeks. It was a really exciting time. The kind of wins were kind of coming left and right. And then we built off that success. And the growth from there is fast and furious. Some of it was our own doing. Some of it was thrust upon us. Almost all of it too early from a scaling perspective, in my opinion. So what we look like now, our current state, we have 20 product teams. And when I say product teams here, I'm talking about user-facing teams that our users are utilizing, warfighters are using to do a thing, to do their job, to provide capability. We also have 18 service teams, and I wanted to call this out separately. We don't name them differently internally, but I wanted to show the amount of investment that goes into an organization at scale, the internal tooling you need. We have a product called RAD that is our kind of UI for the platform that helps us do self-service application deployment, as an example. Anti-corruption layers that allow us to kind of maneuver data from our modern applications to the legacy systems to ensure data doesn't break anything downrange. And force multiplier applications, things like automated testing suites and tools, chaos engineering and all these things, about 18 of those, plus 15 or so platform and support teams, platform orchestration services, infrastructure, identification, our ID management, and that kind of thing. And then we also have 8 legacy programs on top of all of that. And I write these things in teams on purposely. So I think that's the best way to think about an organization is how the teams are structured, because the teams are the ones who are going to end up doing the work. Now on the bottom, you can see here, 1,260 people. That is a lot. It sounds like a lot. It is. About half of that is the legacy program offices that like we kind of inherited, though, to be honest. It's about half of that like modern kind of way of working, DevOps work. Going forward. And we've done a ton of hiring and work with the military side to get new talent. And I'll talk a little bit about that going forward. So all this work's been done by all of these people building all of these products. And they're all aligned towards our business outcomes. And we here in the Air Force are in the business of amassing air power for air superiority. And this ties directly into our Kessel Run vision. Our vision here is to deliver combat capability that can sense and respond to conflict in any domain, anytime, anywhere. This is going to come up about 5 different times in this presentation. It's important that everything within your organization ties back to the vision that you have going forward. So understanding this, think about Kessel Run in a way that you think about a football team, American football, offense, defense, and special teams, right? We have application teams and organizations that are building these user-facing applications. They're at the end of our value stream doing value creation. We also have defense, right? We have a platform infrastructure team that's ensuring that our developers are productive. We have all that underlying thing you need to enable that value to be created. And then day two support, which I think gets forgotten about in a lot of these software factory conversations, to make sure that we are a response to what's happening in the field. We are putting new capability in the middle of a war. We need to be ready to respond to that when things go wrong or we need to change things. So a robust day two support, including site reliability engineering, monitoring, help desk type of support. But just IT is the biggest enabler of business outcomes when it's done well. It can also be the biggest inhibitor when it's done poorly. And we all know about that far too well. Some statistics that aren't going to surprise any of you. 94% of IT projects in the government behind schedule, over budget, 40% of them deliver zero value, don't even deliver a thing. And one number I found interesting, I saw the other day, one third of our IT budget across the government's $30 billion is spent on maintaining legacy systems. Now in a normal like IT world, that's fine, right? If you're maintaining things that are in production, like that's just work you have to do. But we all know what that really means, right? Because those legacy systems largely aren't providing value. It's mostly negative value. So we've all used these systems. So we're spending a third of our budget on maintaining really shitty systems that don't provide the value that we want, that we need. So I thought that was a really interesting thing to see. We're talking about long cycle times, waterfall, outsourcing. Obviously, we are all aware of this, right? Of the government's plight here. But I want to talk about what this does to our business outcomes. The important thing to take away here is that IT doesn't happen in a vacuum. IT has tentacles that affect our actual business outcomes, the things we're here to do. So we are going to go on a bit of a tangent here to talk about what I think my business outcome is around amassing air power. So we're going to talk a little bit of history here. So let's go back to World War II. Centralized control and decentralized execution. It's the mantra of air power since the birth of the Air Force, 1947, right? But that grew from failures to amass air power during World War II, most notably Operation Torch in 43. But despite this doctrine, the DoD struggled to successfully employ air power then in Korea, in Vietnam. The old adage goes, you learn more in defeat than you do in victory. And this held true for us too, where it's actually pretty interesting that we learned a lot of how we do air doctrine now from what Korea actually did successfully. But likewise, we had failures in Vietnam, and we had an analysis of the Arab-Israeli War in 73 that led to the air battle doctrine of the mid-70s, which emphasized maneuver and firepower on a linear battlefield. And this was a focus on handling an overwhelming Soviet force in Europe while we were really worried during the Cold War. So the Army required 72 hours to plan for all these maneuvers on the ground. They divided the battle space into three time frames, close, integrated, and deep over a 72-hour period. And this is where we get our 72-hour air tasking cycle by responding to the Army's needs in the linear air-land battle doctrine, and it underpins everything we do from a command and control perspective. So 72-hour planning cycle, then we have some close air support to handle any immediate requests that come forward, right? So then we get into Desert Storm, Desert Shield in the early 90s. Lieutenant Colonel at the time, Det Tula, built something called the Master Attack Plan, or now known as the Master Air Attack Plan during Desert Storm. And the idea was to link the effects desired by the commanders to a list of targets in a linear approach based on that linear way of working the 72-hour tasking cycle. So it was pretty effective during Desert Shield, but it served far too slow during Desert Storm going forward. So Lieutenant Colonel Moore, who later became the deputy commander of CENTCOM, actually wrote as part of that, the ATO, the air tasking order, does not respond well to a quick action battlefield. We're trying to fight a fluid battle. We need a system that can react. I actually love the middle quote here. It's just funny to me. If you're trying to build a war, you could probably build a pretty good war. It's a funny way that generals talk. So that wasn't working for us. This should sound familiar, right? We talked about our vision statement. We want to deliver combat capability that can sense and respond to conflict. We didn't make this up. Generals have been screaming about it since 1991. But it continues. So these are some numbers from SHIELD and Desert Storm. These are the amount of strikes that take place outside of the ATO. So going into an ATO day or a day of war, We planned every single mission that needs to happen. In Desert Shield, 20% of those got scrapped and replanned in execution, 40% during Desert Storm. So almost half the time, the missions that we spent all that time planning for just went away. We didn't even use them anyway. And this continued to get worse, right? Lessons observed but not learned. Kosovo. So during Kosovo, General Jumper, who's the Air Force Chief of Staff, said that the ATO was basically a force to, or an attempt to force a planning cycle, and mostly between 4 and 6 hours, they were changing targets, changing munitions. We need to figure out ways to shrink those cycles. So now we're in the, you know, the mid-90s, still talking about our 72-hour air tasking cycle not working for us. Then during Freedom, so we're in Afghanistan now, we actually made time-sensitive targeting a doctrinal workaround to the limitation of the way that we were working. I want everybody to think about what the word doctrinal workaround means. We put something in doctrine to avoid the way that we were supposed to work in the first place, all because we can't have a flexible IT infrastructure that allows for data to be available in the way that we need it. Building off of Afghanistan, now we're in Iraqi Freedom. 79% of targets that had ordnance applied against them were done outside of the ATO cycle. Why do we even use it in the first place at this point? We're figuring everything out on the fly. We built a thing called Killbox Interdiction, where we have 30 by 30 mile radius that we just send aircraft out to, and we're just gonna put them in touch with a controller. We're gonna give you coordinates. You're gonna figure it out while you're in the air, right? Why do we have an entire ATO cycle in the first place? Because we haven't been able to respond to it. So you can see these stats here. They continue to go forward. Commanders intentionally circumventing the doctrinal process when it counts in order to get their job done, which they should do. Right? If we're not going to be there to provide the support they need from a data or an IT perspective, do what you got to do to get your job done. IT should be an enabler, not a blocker. And everything's looked the same. There's nothing that's changed the way we fight war from an air perspective since the 70s. And it also looks the same. Here we have a bunch of dudes with computers and TV screens talking to each other. More screens, more computers, all doing the same stuff. In the 90s, they kind of look better. They're flatter, I guess. The 2000s, we got more computer screens, so that's cool. You can get more Excel spreadsheets up in front of you. And then in 2010s, it looks cool. It's basically the same thing, though. You just got thinner screens and the high-definition video. But in reality, all the things are the same. We're fighting in the same way that we used to, because IT cannot adapt to changes on the battlefield. We need to be more flexible. And that leads to situations like this one, where our IT failings meet our outcomes in a really serious way. So October 3rd, 2015, we struck a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Afghanistan. We thought it was an enemy stronghold. If you go through unclassified analysis here, it showed a number of failures that contributed. Afghan commandos were under fire. We had to respond fast, support our coalition partners. There was no time to fully brief the crew, and their aircraft didn't have the latest data. So our C2 ecosystem caused an AC-130 gunship to attack the wrong building. Wasn't the crew member's fault. We failed them with ancient software and stovepiped systems. And ancient software and stovepipe systems are ubiquitous to our military, unfortunately. They exist in every major weapon system. All of your jobs probably have some semblance of this. And what happens in Kunduz is not some sort of, you know, black swan event. It was predictable, and it will happen again. And while what happened there is tragic, it doesn't even begin to compare the what ifs of a major theater war at scale versus a near peer adversary. And I'm glad Brian mentioned in the chat, this is what led Brian to actually coming into acquisitions from the targeting career field to try to fix some of this. So a lot of this stuff led to, you know, a series of events down the road. But we can't have this conversation about business outcomes and forget our reality. Failure to us is not a loss of subscribers. It's not a loss of revenue. It's a loss of lives. And it makes things really important for the way that we work. So that's our problem to solve, right? We'll throw that on top of dozens of antiquated hardware stacks around the world that can't communicate, on-prem hosting of everything, 30-year-old software that only like 3 people in the world know how to maintain, requiring specific humans in specific buildings in specific places, so using specific computers to get specific data going forward. With vulnerabilities galore and IT cluster on top of this massive product problem we have. So imagine here, you have what you can see here. I won't read through all this, but basically it's Iran saying that, actually, we don't need to make sure that we have weapons that can reach the United States. I can reach every US military installation in the Middle East right on my doorstep. So I feel pretty good about that. We're not afraid to do that, right? So fast forward to 2019, series of events, drone gets shot down, general assassination. Now we have where the war is fought, the 609th AOC in Qatar, in the middle of ICBM range of Iran, right across the water, in a physical location, because our IT can't be flexible enough to allow them to get access to data they need. We physically have to be there, right? That's crazy to think about, that because of our IT situation, we have people literally in harm's way when Iran is literally saying that they're willing to strike us if they need to. It's crazy to think about. It looks like that up front. And this is the problem that we're trying to solve within Kessel Run, is how do we build the air operations way of working, the air operations center ecosystem in a way that's dynamically makes data available. You can do it from anywhere. You're not tied down, anchored to these systems and buildings in a really antiquated way. So in order to solve this, we need to simplify, right? The C2 process itself, risk aside, is a medium scale supply chain and logistics problem. Like, how do we assure that our resources are staged appropriately in order to react to requests and fulfill them as required? FedEx does this every day, 16 million packages, and Christmas is about 28 million packages at its peak. Hubs all over the globe that allow us to do that, data shared all over the place. We need to move towards this model, towards a more dynamic way of resourcing aircraft for air campaigns. We need to schedule air power like we hail an Uber, or like we used to when we used to go places. And I recognize that Uber is a played out analogy and is used for everything, but I think it works here. I need a thing to be in a place at a certain time as a user. Behind that request, a boatload of logistics and resource allocation infrastructure and algorithm developments. We're trying to find the most efficient way to meet that need. Now the analogy kind of breaks down from there, but you can get my point. We can't have a linear cycle of working. We dynamically react to needs on a battlefield. And don't forget the vision, right? We already talked about it. Combat capability that can sense and respond to conflict in any domain, anytime, anywhere. But wait, there's more. I have a whole nother problem that we didn't even talk about yet. We don't even know when we need this system, right? Imagine you're a product professional and you have to design a system for a scenario that's never happened before. Nobody's ever experienced it. Your users can't articulate it, and we hope it never happens, right? It's a really hard problem, if not impossible. Imagine, our users don't even have a concept of what this would look like in reality. Our stakeholders don't understand the possibilities of technology that we can now enable. It leaves us in a tough spot. Imagine being in retail and not knowing when Black Friday would be, if ever, right? At least we can prepare for when that day is right now. So we're left in a position where we know we're going to be wrong. It would be impossible for us to be right about this. So how can we mitigate that in the best way we can? Small incremental change leading to a wholly resilient, reliable, flexible system that allows us to, you guessed it, sense and respond to conflict whenever we need to. The way that we're doing that, using Gall's Law, right? A simple or a complex system that works, invariably found to have evolved from a simple system that worked. The inverse is almost never true. We have to start simple. We have to start small. We have to build smartly from there. And that's basically the story of Kessel Run, where we got started. So we started here. All around the world, there are fighter jets refueled midair by refueling tankers all over the place. It's one of the cooler, most like underrated things we do in the Air Force. We talk about fighter jets all the time. This is pretty cool. So we need to ensure that the right aircraft with the right hardware in the right location at the right altitude, at the right time, with the right amount of fuel is in the right place. Then make sure all the fighters are planning around that too. It's a bit of a symphony in the sky, if you will. You can see the complexity there around making sure the resources are where you need them to be. When we came around, it was done like this. There's a guy on a whiteboard moving pucks around. Most of you heard this story before. I'm going to go quick. This guy would yell across the room to another dude to make sure something was feasible. They'd adjust it. He yelled to another dude whose entire job was to type a plan into Microsoft Excel with a macro, all in the middle of a massive pilot shortage, right? So these guys aren't like, they didn't go to data input school coming out of the academy. These are pilots pulled from their jets, deployed to the Middle East, away from their family, to type stuff into a spreadsheet that software should be doing for you anyway, all in the middle of a massive pilot shortage. So we built a small prototype to kind of solve this problem pretty quickly. Jigsaw eventually looked like this. We took their process and we digitized it. First, it was pretty manual, automating more and more over time. The initial kind of MVP that we got out there with the efficiencies gained saved about $214,000 a day, which is pretty cool. 1 year, 30 iterations later, it's about $428,000 a day. We doubled that. It's only like a crazy amount of money, $12 million a month or something. We also built an auto-planning algorithm over time that we've tested. It's beat the human super user significantly that we're working to get into production. So this is a small part of that, right? So now we have this entire problem within the entire air tasking cycle that we're here to solve. Jigsaw and tanker planning are just one part of that. This doesn't even include the F-35 maintenance work that we took on. We needed to chip away slowly, though. So what we started to do is kind of chip away at this air tasking cycle, solving specific kind of problems all over the place where we could. We realized pretty quickly we needed to take a more holistic approach. The local optimization wasn't getting us where we needed to go. We needed to optimize for the whole across the entirety of this air tasking cycle. As an example, when we think through Jigsaw, so when we solved the Jigsaw problem, or at least started to early on, we realized that the amount of time it took for those planners, their job went from like 8 hours to 4 hours. I'm making the numbers up, I don't have them in front of me. And we were like, oh, that's great. So we just gained back 4 hours of war fighting time, analytic time or whatever. I wonder how they're using that. So we went back, we're like, how are you using this free time that we got you? They're like, I don't know, I'm going home and playing more video games. Like, okay, that didn't really go well. So we've like optimized locally, their jobs are easier, but we really didn't do anything to optimize for the whole, that were the actual outcome that we have as an organization. It made us really start thinking differently about value streams and wanting to focus on the right things across the entirety of this cycle. So yes, evolvable architectures, but we probably should have done more scaffolding earlier. I think we missed a bit of a transition point to get from these kind of siloed user-focused applications to more of a systems of systems approach. We're kind of there now. I think it took me a little bit too long to kind of come around to that one and figure that one out over time. But even with that, we have a number of successful products that have all come together to support our warfighting operations that are going on as we speak. And don't listen to me, listen to our users tell you about it.
I'm Colonel Trey Colton, commander of the 609th Air Operations Center. I'd like to tell you a little about how the 609th is working with Kessel Run to pull the AOC weapons system out of the past and into the future. Slapshot is a great tool for me as the map chief because what it allows me to do is schedule the aircraft that are in theater.
What Chainsaw does, it allows us in the dynamic targeting cell to be able to collaborate across multiple sections here in the KOC.
Jigsaw has changed the way that ARCT has planned and executed tanker operations by decreasing the planning timeline.
We ingest a lot of mission reports from every single flight that happens here in the CENTCOM AOR. All of those are tracked and approved by us here at the KOC, and in the past, a lot of those tracking systems were clunky and hard to use.
609th EACOMS and Kessel Run have the shared vision of providing enhanced weapon system lethality and mission assurance.
The second thing it does is it communicates to everyone in the AOC as well as in the AOR. So anybody that has access to Slapshot has the ability to go and look at it and get a 24-hour picture of what's going on in theater at any given time.
What Chainsaw allows me to do is enter the targets that we're worried about into Chainsaw itself. And that way, as soon as I put it in there, it populates on everybody's computers, which allows them to see it and collaborate real time.
Jigsaw has changed the way that we're doing business at the AOC by visualizing the plan as well as communicating that plan across the teams and the divisions within the weapon system.
Marauder makes it really easy to have drop-down menus and a tabular layout that makes it so everyone can read and understand the information, and we're able to pull information from that and make assessments based on that.
What we have with Kessel Run, though, is in more of a transparency. We work directly with the developers and the engineers that are fielding the capabilities. They're not only just one phone call away, but they have a presence on site as well.
I think it increases its productivity. So I think it cuts down on unnecessary applications that you wouldn't normally need. So it's kind of taken a lot of things that were done in different types of software before, and it's brought them together.
So the way it's affected the mission is that it's allowed us to strike targets quicker, in a quicker fashion, and it's allowed us mostly to prepare for the next major war. And so it gives us the ability to practice in a better fashion, so that if we do have the next near-peer war, it'll allow us to execute quicker against the targets that we're more worried about in order to allow our forces to move in.
We need to be more resilient. We need to be more agile. We need to be more lean. And Kessel Run can get us there if we all get behind it. The 609th and Kessel Run, pulling the AOC weapon system out of the past and into the future.
I just found out the check cleared that we sent out to the 609th for them to say those things. That's good. That was really cool of them to do that. There's nothing better than hearing your users sing your praises, so you don't have to keep doing it yourself. Yeah, that was pretty cool. So we're here to talk about scaling. We talked a little bit about the Kessel Run kind of growth kind of over time. So I want to talk a little bit about what that looked like from an organizational and a management perspective and how that affected me kind of personally in my job. So when I started, Jason mentioned earlier, we had a product team. This is very simplified, mostly wrong, but I'm going to get my point across, I think. We had a team here. We're building a thing. And this is me right there, right? And this is back when I had hair. I had a lot of it. I used to put it in a bun, thought it was cool. Then it left. But this was me in this team. And this was like a simpler time, right? This is when we could think about like focus directly on what our warfighter needs, on focusing all of my brain power and solving this one problem, which is really powerful, right? For like when, you know, all of us who are in government or in like whatever job you're in, if you're like balancing a million things every day, it's like crazy when you can use all of your brain towards a single problem. That's what being on a product team was like. And I loved that kind of simplified feeling and nature of things. So then we were able to kind of do some work there. I worked with Jason and I learned a lot about fundamentals of product stuff that I think are necessary, mandatory in order to be a good leader in product. You have to know what your teams are doing and how they're thinking about problems and challenges, because all of this stuff is fractal at every level. So I learned a lot of fundamental things there, and I got really lucky being able to work with Jason in particular, an expert in the field on just our product team, which was great. So as I moved from there, Kessel Run got to a place where we had like six teams or so, and all of a sudden we had this need for like product leadership. And again, I'm simplifying this. So I have this person here doing product leadership. There's also a whole team of people, all those founders I mentioned, Jeremiah, Brian, and Enrique, who are doing all the business stuff to make Kessel Run a thing and talking to all the important people to like convince them that what we're doing makes sense. And I got to focus downward, and I always really appreciated that, where I could think about how can I make all of these teams be as effective as possible. This is me at that time, see my hair left. And the goal here was, how can I make sure that we have ingrained culture and practices and things that we wanna do? This is kind of easy, to be honest, right? This is like enough people where like, you know all their names, you probably hang out with some of them, you know like all their people, their significant others' names, who has kids. It's a really easy way, comparatively at least, to build the culture that you want going forward, because you can manage, you can garden it, you can kind of really maintain it in an easy way. Then you keep moving forward, and now all of a sudden you have like 12 teams, and like we're all building towards a similar, this is where things started cracking. This is where all of a sudden the things that like, we start seeing some atrophy around practices and culture things, because you can't put like the specific effort on every person who comes in. Now we're bringing people in from different backgrounds and different companies who have different ways of working from engineering and product perspective that we're trying to ingrain. And this is where, when we were partnering with Pivotal still at this point, we really relied on them to help us do that throughout all of these teams to make sure that we had that support. But it got really hard, and we needed to start ensuring and fighting that apathy everywhere. And then we basically got to this point. By the end of my time in product leadership, I had about 22 teams, about 250 people, and everything that worked before no longer works at this scale. Like, I'm pretty sure it's everything. So all of the things you used to do as a leader, the relationship you built, the way you talked, the way you communicated, none of that works at all anymore. And all of a sudden you have to become an entirely different professional overnight, which is really interesting. I think it's a dilemma that a lot of founders have in the startup world as well, that like the things that made you successful don't anymore. Meaning all the experience and data and success you had that made people confident in you to put you in this position, go out the window, and now they're just like trusting you to be this entirely different person and lead an entirely different way. It's really, really hard. So we've had to find a bunch of ways to fix our strategic communication. The biggest thing that's broken down here is ensuring that the messaging, vision, strategy that we have at this level get through that middle management tier that you need just to manage all the communication channels. You can be as flat as you want. You still need a thing there to kind of manage the communication. It becomes really hard. So that really broke down. We're actually still trying to figure out the best way to do it. I wouldn't say this one's solved yet. That strategic communication across the organization to make Kessel Run be Kessel Run with 1,200 people. You can't just do overnight. You have to really work at it. And the things that we want to focus on, the only way it's successful is that if we have empowered teams who can go do their jobs on their own, right? Who have the ability and the autonomy and empowerment to go solve the problems that we brought them in. They're all the experts. How do we give them that autonomy? The problem with empowerment is you need alignment. If you don't have alignment first, people are just gonna be empowered all over the place, going in wildly different directions.
And here we are at the start of the first event of the afternoon, the second semi-final of the 100 yards for people with no sense of direction. I'll just give you the competitors. Lane 1, Skolimowski of Poland. Lane 2, Zalapatit of France. Lane 3, Grobovich of the United States. Next to him, Drabble of Trinidad. Next to him, Fernandez of Spain. And in the outside lane, Orman of Brazil.
Don't want that. Can be empowered in different directions. You need alignment first, and this is really hard. You have to be able to get your organization all moving in the same direction, knowing what your shared outcomes are that you're trying to achieve, and communicate it all of the time, constantly, until you're annoying. Until people start telling you that you're being annoying, you haven't gotten there yet. That's a really hard thing for me, and I really struggle with it. I'm trying to figure out best ways to do it. Multiple forums. Imagine having 1,200 people. All of them hear things in a different way. All of them translate things in a different way. Some of them like to read, some of them like videos, some of them like verbal talks. It's really, really hard. You have to keep doing it in order to get there. You can't have alignment until you have clarity, which is why you need to do all of that work. So I think in a lot of ways, we're still at the bottom of this, building the clarity needed for people to be aligned, to then be empowered, to then get like all of the, you know, I like to say that like my job is to like manage and manipulate the collective cognitive abilities of the team in the right way. Like the only way to do that is through empowerment. You can't do it yourself. It has to be happening systematically, but you need to do the work up front to be able to get there. Jason's on, my favorite Jason Fraser quote. Prioritization happens whether you're deliberate about it or not. At the end of the day, you did stuff and you didn't do what you didn't do. You need to have empowerment and alignment and clarity into what the priorities are of the organization so that when you're not around and teams need to go make a decision, they already know what to do because they're already on the same page. So that takes me a bit to the end of my like product leadership time at Kessel Run. I took a little bit of a turn within my role here. So we get to this point, right? And now Kessel Run is a beacon of DevOps across the Department of Defense, right? We are the pioneers and everybody's looking to us to prove how DevOps works and how it will work in the government, sort of. Internally, this is the way that I felt. We broke every part of this. This was not happening within Kessel Run and largely is still not today. This is me giving you all the inside baseball that I can. Over time, we built a clear bifurcation between our organization, between our application development teams and our operators and our platform. In retrospect, a mixture of organizational design, a mixture of bad hires, a mixture of poor decisions that got us into a place where our application organization and our platform were on two different planets entirely. And I deserve a lot of the blame here, right? I was a really poor bridge builder. I had a tough time navigating an organization with completely different set of values and principles, ways of working than I had. And I didn't do a good enough job of trying to figure out how to translate between the two teams. So this turned into app teams wondering what was so hard about platform development and platform folks wondering why the app teams kept yelling at them. And we had to find ways to try to solve this. So a little bit earlier this year, Gene Kim, a writer of Phoenix Project and Unicorn Project Accelerate, he came by with Todd Longstaff, who's the CTO of SCI, as well as with Mitt Kirsten, who's not pictured, who wrote Project to Product, and Jeff Gallimore, who was mentioned earlier, one of his folks is on the line. And they came and spent an entire day with us. It was actually a really like kind of crucial moment in my career. It was really awesome. Brian came up and we spent the day together. And the things I got out of that, I'll never forget. After the visit, it was about a day and a half, we got notes back from like what they saw. They deep dive into our processes and our thoughts and like the way that we were working. And what they realized, their big takeaway, was that we had two separate organizations. From their perspective, our platform organization was optimized for scale, right? They were prioritizing technical decisions, aiming to get to this defined utopian end state of what the platform needs to be at the end of the day. Right? That's what their perspective was. On the app side, he said, which I was leading, so they were optimized for speed, getting user value out as fast as possible, but maybe not investing enough in security, technical debt, architecture considerations. And what happens, we were like speaking completely past each other on how to be successful here. Fast forward a few months, we're working through some organizational design with some growth and how we're gonna organize the organization going forward. This is where the three product lines came. My boss came to me and said, Adam, what do you think about taking over platform? And I laughed, I thought he was just kidding. And that was the end of the conversation. Then he came back and asked me again. And I said, no, I'm a product person. Like, what do I know about platforms? What can I bring to a service or a technical organization? I wanna go do product stuff. And then he came back again and asked me again. And as I thought about it, I got more and more intrigued about the possibility and being able to use some different muscles. So I ended up moving over to lead the platform organization as a way to build empathy and build that bridge that all the people who I've helped build and grow and have great relationships with on the app side now know that me leading the platform organization, I have their best interests at heart, and we can bring those organizations closer together. So what I did when I came in is I did a virtual Gemba walk and met with every one of the teams to learn how their processes work, how they take in priorities, how they process information, how they do their work, and learned a lot about some of our problems. And here are the four things that I've kind of tackling as our kind of initial initiatives in the platform side to bring this DevOps organization back to where it needs to go. The first is increasing our customer centricity. We need everybody to understand that everybody has a user, everybody has a customer, including service and technical organizations. Our developers are the users of the products that you're building, and we didn't really have that perspective just yet. We really need to understand that everybody has to know where they live within the value stream and how they are affecting change both downstream and upstream. Things like understanding our service offerings and having roadmaps available so we can plan off of just the basic product principles and practices weren't happening. So we're focusing on a lot of that now. The second is increased flow. We had a lot of poor internal practices that led to delivery being slow. We had capacity problems. At one point I asked all of our teams, okay, let's say you have 100 hours worth of capacity on your team. How much of that are you planning? Like, I don't know, 90% of it. And then later I'd ask, like, how much unplanned work do you have? Like, I don't know, 60%. I'm like, okay, let's add those two things together. It doesn't really work. So we had capacity problems, and it came down to that lack of alignment and understanding what priorities were and kind of poor work visualization. I really understood the power behind visualizing your work because so you can understand where your blockers and queues and wait times are. The third, increased dev productivity. One of the big takeaways I got from our meeting, and if you've read anything that Gene Kim writes, this won't be a surprise to you. Developer productivity is essential. He talked about how most, you know, major kind of companies in industry put their best developers towards developer productivity and their interns on feature development. We were completely flipped here, in all honesty, right? We were trying to get out in front of our users and give them what they needed. And we were like not prioritizing the things that make, you know, everybody get better and more productive. So we're putting a real emphasis on increased developer productivity throughout kind of our pipelines and building a self-service platform that allows less manual interactions to get for work to get done. And then lastly, increased employee engagement. I'm a firm believer that happy employees make better stuff. I don't think that culture and, you know, psych safety, all these things, you don't just do it to have like a happy workplace so people are just nice. You do it to make yourself more effective, and all these things make you more effective as an organization. So instituting a focus on professional development, sustainable pace, employee net promoter scores, diversity, all of these things are super important and a real focus strategically for us going forward. And the last thing here, all this comes together, applications and platforms to build what is being described elsewhere as a software factory. I hate this term. To me, a factory is a place where inputs come in, and at the end, there's outputs that come out of it. And your job internally is to do that as efficiently as possible. Make your inputs turn into outputs. I think that only tells part of the story of the work that we have to do. I care about the inputs, right? I'm working with our users, understanding requirements, understanding what they need. I'm part of that process. I'm also part of day two of understanding what happens once the things leave the factory, understand the outcomes that happen or don't happen in day two operations from a more technical perspective. I think the term software factory limits the scope of what we need to do as IT professionals in a DevOps world. So that's a little bit of a soapbox. But I'm going long, so I'm gonna wrap up here with some actual lessons learned. This is actually kind of cathartic for me to actually write down what my lessons learned were. I don't think I've ever done it. So I have a bunch here. I'm gonna go quick. First, maintain humility with success. We didn't do a good job of this. I didn't do a good job of this. I think that Kessel Run would be in a better position now if we did a better job of messaging early on, that we didn't know all the right answers, that we brought people along with us. And I think like we've changed the last year or so, we're messaging differently, but the damage has already been done. So now I have to rebuild a lot of relationships in order to like make them productive, which is really unfortunate. And I have nobody to blame but myself here. So I would think this is important to maintain that humility, even if you have some success early on. The second, meet your customers where they are, all of them, not just the ones you like. I think we do this well with users. Like, we want to understand, talk our users' language. I didn't do a good job of this from a stakeholder perspective of understanding where people who live within that, we talk about frozen middle and bureaucrats and all of this, they have a job to do that is important, and you need to be able to translate what you're doing into a language they can understand. The people on this call are the people who are okay with change and like thrive in ambiguity. That is not most of the world. So we have to do a better job of understanding where people are coming from and talk to them at their level. People always say, don't stop learning. I want to say, don't stop teaching. Your values aren't as sticky as you think they are. And you have to continuously fight to make sure that people understand where you're coming from. This is both internal and external. Your culture and your practices and your principles can fade as easy as you've built them, maybe quicker. So you have to keep teaching this and keep talking about it, and don't assume that you're done. I think I did a bad job of assuming that I got to some point where like, all right, I have enough people thinking and talking this way that it's gonna permeate organically through the whole of the organization. Just not how it works in my experience. I think a lot of us too fight with this imposter syndrome. Like, why am I the authority on this? Like, should I be the person selling this? You are the authority on this if you're in this call. And I think that you have to do a good job of like owning that yourself to ensure you're constantly telling the story you need to tell and speaking your truth and fighting through that imposter syndrome. Okay, also don't stop learning. That was a good one. Don't get complacent. The world's changing too fast. I think the one thing that I'm good at is I don't have a problem telling my team where I don't know things. I'm okay not knowing stuff, particularly in the technical side of the house. And I think that credible leaders showing vulnerability and knowledge and a willingness to learn things they don't know goes a long way. The world changes too fast. In 2006, you were on your Motorola Razr. You're playing Snake. Some of you got really good at it. I was never very good at it. If I asked you at that time to like explain to me the specs of the iPhone 11, you're like, you can't conceivably do it. It's impossible. And the distance between the Motorola Razr and the iPhone 11 is the same time of the average requirements and cycle time of DoD programs. So like the idea that we think we can say what's going to happen up front is a complete fallacy. There's no way to conceive of it in the same way that a fish can't conceive of fire. And this goes the same way from a personal perspective when we think about our own learning. The World Economic Forum said that 50% of the things you learn the first year of a technical degree are obsolete by the time you graduate. We are in a really hard job that all of us have just decided for the rest of our lives, we have to learn new stuff constantly or we're going to be dinosaurs, right? That sucks. It's going to be a lot of work for all of us, but you guys have like decided to do it. So you got to like be prepared. This is a constant learning for the rest of your lives to be successful in this line of work. Conway's Law is a weapon. Employ it. Conway's Law any organization that designs a system will produce a design whose structure is a copy of the organization's communication structure. The way you organize your people is what your product will come to look like. And the thing I want to say here is don't talk about it like we need to avoid the pitfalls of Conway's Law. Use it as a weapon. Use it aggressively for you in order to get where you want to go. And I think you can have some success. Never tech for tech's sake. All of your technical decisions should be based on your business outcomes. Your users don't care how you manage your clusters. I think you guys have all seen this one. Tech stuff largely doesn't matter. I like this analogy. If you order food right now, this is the interaction that you care about, getting your food on time. It's hot. It's good. There's a bunch of stuff that exists behind this, right? There's infrastructure. There's a system to get like the right drivers in place. The restaurant has to be able to take your credit card payment. Grubhub has to take their cut. Users don't care about any of that stuff. They just want food. So make sure that the technical decisions that you're making are based on the business outcomes that you want to achieve and not just because your engineers want to do something cool. Seven, maintain your culture like you maintain your code base. Culture debt is easy to miss. We need to invest in it continuously to get towards this generative organization and not the bureaucratic or even pathological organization that we've seen. Invest in your people regardless of their past, regardless of their path. It's our responsibility as leaders to do that. Even if they're a military folk who's leaving or somebody who you know is going to go to a new job, still invest in them. It's all one ecosystem. It's all going to come back to benefit you. In our example here, all those places on the right are places that people from Kessel Run have gone off to. A lot of them in government, your space camps and Section 31s and whatever. Also externally, Facebook, AWS, we have like really great places that people have gone and come back into. This ecosystem is all one. It's all going to come back to benefit us. So invest in your people. And the last one, fight the theater with everything you've got. Measurable outcomes are what matter in production. Brian, do you want to say it? Prodder, it didn't happen. But don't fall victim to vanity metrics and keep your eye on growing cargo culting. Make sure your people in your organization know why they do the things you do. If you do stand-ups every day, do they even know why? Do they just do retros because you told them to? All of these things are important to keep an eye on. Fight the theater. Don't fall victim to, you know, promoting your own myth. Some ways to do that from a metrics perspective, DORA metrics here, which are really good that we try to track. We like to think that products are our currency and user adoption is the valuation of that currency, tip Max Real. But even these things are correlation and proxy metrics. They're good, but you need to actually sure you're measuring your actual outcomes. But this is wicked hard to actually do this, and we're still working on how to do it, but you have to actually know what those outcomes are. Bonus lesson before we wrap up. You have to actually watch the movie. If you're part of an organization that is based on a theme on a movie, you should watch the movie. This is a quote that I got quoted on. I didn't know we were on the record in the Boston Globe. It's caused me a lot of strife internally because all my people know now that I didn't watch Star Wars. I don't know what they're talking about. And the conference rooms make no sense to me. Okay. So with that, everything we do here needs to be on mission focus. And I think all of us on this call are here for the right reasons. Everything we do is for users. So make sure all of the organizational things you're doing, the design, the technical decisions, the everything is based around, at the end of the day, what are the outcomes that we are achieving in production for our warfighters is the most important thing. And we have to make sure to measure it. So with that, that is all I have. My information is down there. If you want to reach out, feel free. And I am going to stop talking for a minute and get some water. Thanks.
Adam, absolutely incredible. So I think we're going to start like an AMA now. Caleb had to drop for another meeting, but please, y'all, this is your chance to hang with Adam for about 24 minutes and ask him any questions you have.
Hey, Adam, I have a question for you. So as you shift in your role from being product focused for the first 3 years of Kessel Run, and you move into this other role, essentially going from day zero and day one concerns into the day two concerns, how do you, what is the strategy that you're going to try and employ when you find the amount of technical debt in your day two and have to carry that back to your day zero and day one pieces? How are you sort of thinking about that in terms of, you know, it's a heavier lift now that it's in production supporting users?
Good question. We're having these conversations now. I think the thing that I can do, I think the value that I can provide here is translation. I think the thing that we've always struggled with is that the folks in the more technical side of the house have a really hard time translating technical decisions into terms that matter to people who are on the application side. I think that what I can do is help the translation. So one thing that I tell our folks all the time now is like, if they can like make me understand things, then I can like communicate them in terms that like application people care. I actually call it the Luna rule. So we have a product manager on our team named Krista Luna. She's amazing. She's actually a former Air Force enlisted person that we built into a really good product manager. She's admittedly not technical at all though, right? So we have a rule on our platform side now that anytime you need to like describe a platform or a technical thing, you have to do it to a degree that Krista can understand it. I don't mean that pedantically. We talked about it. And I think that helps by making our engineering staff be able to communicate things in a more effective way from an outcomes perspective and translate some of that. So to answer your question, we do have a ton of tech debt that we have to prioritize, but I need to be able to tell my stakeholders on the application side why, if I don't prioritize this tech debt now, it's going to come down to bite you in the ass later from an outcomes perspective. And I don't think there's anybody in our organization who could like bridge those two things effectively up to this point. So that's kind of what I'm hoping to bring. So I think it's more about communication and translation than it is about the actual like technical decisions that need to be made, I think.
Hey, you see this question from Matt Nelson?
what clarity and alignment techniques have you used to gain alignment with your offstage? Yeah, good point. I've sucked at this. I always think I'm good at it, but I don't think that I am. I actually watched, so the guy who replaced me on the application side, name's Lottie, James Lashby, he's a colonel, came from like ACC before this job. And I actually was watching him in a briefing, and the way that he was able to communicate the things that I think I've been saying for 2 years, but in a way that like they understood, it was amazing, right? And that's actually what made me put that lessons learned about meeting your kind of users or customers where they are, that like he was able to kind of take the things that we were already saying, put them in a format that like triggered things in people's heads, and like the same information just clicked because he was using their words and their formatting and that kind of thing. So that's why I think like we have to make sure, as much as we want to stick to our guns and we have all these strong opinions about the way the world should work, I think that there's like a nuanced way to get there that we maybe have to do a better job of like being okay with, at least temporarily, to build that. So I'd say that was one of the things. What challenges, if any, have you faced with your efforts replaced that of a different development organization? Interesting. So most of our stuff's internal, but might be harder. I would say we are certainly having conversations around, like, half our staff right now are our legacy staff. I don't know if that's a pejorative at this point, but like we have to figure out how to make sure that we are being very clear and transparent about our goals as an organization. And I think one of the things, some of them do get angry and some of them don't, you know, like the approach we're taking. But I think the important thing here is like bringing them along with that process and like making them part of, like, if you tell one of these organizations, like, your goal, the outcome that you have is to do X, Y, or Z, which may include not existing anymore, it allows people to kind of come together and solutionize, and also include some reskilling and upskilling and that kind of thing. I think one thing that we struggled with, Sam, here, though, is like, we kind of did that messaging before the thing was built in a lot of times, where like we were talking about the future, like, once we build this thing, we're gonna replace this. And like, we didn't really have the credibility yet to be kind of making those claims. So I think there are ways to message that differently, where we were waiting a little bit more to see when the delivery came and like when we had tangible results that actually had some weight behind what we were saying, rather than like, our roadmap tells us you're not gonna exist anymore, when like, all right, let's do some of the work and then come tell me about your roadmap. Cool. There's some resources you could point to that we're trying to establish some of these processes within our company. Yeah, for sure. I can give you like a list of books and things like that. Yeah, let me, can I follow up with that though? Aaron, we have like ways to contact people. I'll put it in the Slack channel at the very least. And I know like, I see Matt on and Brian and company have some other materials too. We can put together a list to send out to the group.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Cool. You mentioned targeting capabilities, whether you're talking points, what activities do you currently have in play to streamline the information flow in the overall sensor to shooter cycle? Yeah, it's a good question. I think, we're in this weird point from like a product perspective that is a bit of a struggle, right? So we have the ABMS world kind of off and running, trying to like define this, you know, future vision and doing their kind of experimenting and things like that. And then we have on our side like this legacy system that we just described for, you know, 30 minutes or whatever, on how and the inability of it to adapt and to maneuver. And so I want to get to a place of that like dynamism we talked about, where we are constantly like sensing and responding to change. Before I could do any of that, I just need software that works. So I think that there's like an approach we're taking that like, we are not going to solve that dynamic ATO problem anytime soon. In order to even get there though, I need to have cloud native software that allows them to do the job they're doing today, maybe, hopefully more efficiently with less people and all of that, that then sets me up to do some of those things, right? Underlying infrastructures and event streams and all of that. So I don't know if we're. I think where you're going with the conversation, I don't know if we have anything like in the hopper that's going to like fundamentally change the game from a sensor to shooter perspective. What we are going to have is a fundamentally different way to do operational C2 to make data available to make those things even a possibility going forward. It's the same thing when people talk about data science. They always want to like bring all these data scientists to do all this algorithm work, but in reality, all the work you have to do is mostly plumbing and observability and data engineering stuff. And I think that from a product perspective, that's kind of where we're at, is like building an ecosystem that we can build off of going forward, which is maybe like not as sexy as people want to hear, but it's like the next thing we have to do. How are you countering USAF-wide innovation theater with effective use of your mission outcomes? I don't know, maybe we're not. I don't know that it's my job to do that. I think like early on in Kessel Run, we had an approach to, again, our statement, our vision was to make the Air Force a software company, right? And I think at some point we woke up one day and we were like, oh shit, like that's great. But like we have all this like operational need now and like users and stuff. So I think that we've made a bit of a pivot maybe to being really delivery focused and trying to get our own house in order. And I think we've like scaled so fast that like the list of things we have to do to like be the Kessel Run everybody thinks we are is long, right? We have a lot of work to do. So I don't worry about things like that. I don't know if that's the right decision or not, but that's kind of the approach we're taking, is like, I want to get to a point where my work can speak for itself. And I don't have to worry about the messaging in the theater. We're not there, but we're doing everything we can to get there.
Adam, this is Matt. I got a follow-up question to that statement. So like, what are the main like faulty assumptions that you would want to like externally communicate to the DoD innovation community about Kessel Run? I know like you guys are trying to get your house in order, but there are still some things that you need to externally communicate. What are those like main faulty assumptions or things that could be inaccurate that you want to message to like kind of clear the air?
Well, I think the software factory part of it, I think, is the main one, because it affects like funding considerations and real things that matter. I think that the everybody likes to think they're unique. I think this like the growth, the scale that we've got to, like we are in a unique position where like the way that it's actually interesting to think about, right? So AOC 10.1, the actual program office that we were going to replace, is really just infrastructure that brings external products together and makes them run, right? Like we weren't doing any of the work to build capabilities. And I don't think people realize that like all of the air ops work to build new stuff is like completely incongruent with replacing the thing that already existed. That's more on the platform side, right? The infrastructure that allows you to deliver capability. So we've actually like doubled our workload, then add the amount of acquisition work that gets thrown on top of that to make even all of that like possible. And we've like added so much to our plates that I don't think people realize, including day two operations, which frankly, nobody's doing well yet, right? And I think there's a ton of work to do there. So I think the thing I'd like to get across is like, I don't know what to call it. I don't know what Kessel Run is. I know that, I know what it isn't. I don't think it's a software factory. Not that that's like a bad thing to be. I just think there's like so much more we're responsible for that's been really hard for us to like translate, especially we're starting to see like, MAGCOMs and the Pentagon try to like standardize stuff and define things. And this is what this means now. And this is like, now it's getting a little bit scary for me, right? That like the bureaucracy is closing in. So I want to make sure that we are like firm in where we're at. I don't know that we've messaged that super clearly.
Hey Adam, Steve McKay, I had one quick question for you. Do you have boot camps to help build this kind of capability across the enterprise and share the experience? And do you have like exchanges with other teams to help build up, the mindset that they need to have to build capabilities in their own native organizations?
We don't. We used to do a lot of that. I think when I talked about that pivot a little bit towards like helping solve the Air Force's or DoD's problems, towards like focusing on our own kind of focus area, that's one of the things that we kind of stopped doing, to be honest. I know like Platform One does some of that. I think it's a massive need. I think you're highlighting something that should exist. And I've, you know, made that point to, you know, people within the Air Force hierarchy that people need more help. But no, we don't provide that as a service or anything right now. Happy to share whatever thing I know with you, you know, and exchange information, but we don't have like a program set up or anything.
Adam, I can't thank you enough for doing this today. Taking an hour and 18 minutes out of your day to share some of your wisdom with this crew. Much appreciated. For all of you else, thanks for joining today. For those who asked, I dropped your email to the Slack. You should have an invite. Please join the combo. This is great. Thanks, y'all, for being on. We'll see you next month. Out of here.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. We love ideas and feedback, so feel free to send your thoughts to hello@deaf.org. For more great content and to stay in the loop about community events and activities, follow us on social media and subscribe to our monthly newsletter. Everyone plays a part in building the innovative national security culture we want to see. To find where you fit, just go to deaf.org/join. That's def.org/join.